out there.
Yeah. You want to jump a little bit?
Well, it does kind of make you feel like that, doesn't it?
See one of those big lines?
Yeah. Here's your drink, Jed. I'll be cheering. Okay. This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs meeting in Hearing Room C at 1 o'clock p.m. on Tuesday, May the 10th, 1977.
The order. The clerk will note those present. The first witness is Commissioner Morgan.
Are you going to take some of the
I, for the benefit of the committee, the commissioner asked the commission to say a few more or less introductory remarks concerning the entire program. Then the first bill that we are going to hear, and if we're in agreement with the bill, I would certainly entertain a motion to pass it out, because that one is important to the commissioner's program, as I understand it. So go ahead.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner? Wait a minute. He is to me. Senator.
Is it true that Ross Morgan left for the Republican on account of you, Mr. Chairman?
I think it was the Wires family that got so much under his skin that he finally left one way or another.
At the record show, we're starting with House Bill 2133.
Just came out of Hood River.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ross Morgan, Administrator of the Employment Division. We're happy to be here today and be able to start with these bills with you, and I beg your indulgence to give you some kind of a background of our program, because I know that some of you are not familiar and haven't been on Labor Committee in the past. So while I may do that, I'll go forward and then we'll get right into these bills, Mr. Chairman. In American society, the dignity of man has often been related to that which he could gain by the sweat of his brow. When a man was not gainfully employed, his dignity and oftentimes his survival depended upon the benevolence of his employer or some other individual or group. Only recently has Western man placed emphasis on the right to dignity as well as survival. The principles of this work ethic cast a stigma on any system which protected the unemployed. Unemployment was viewed as being synonymous with incompetence and with incompetent people who need to be cared for through charity. The disastrous economic crisis of 1929 clearly demonstrated the inadequacies of the labor market built solely on supply and demand. And as a result of this crisis and the ensuing millions of unemployed people, the premise that gainful employment was be available to all who would work was challenged. 30 years has passed since the creation of a program aimed at developing basic protection for wage earners and a nation against economic adversity. The unemployment insurance program was designed to provide survival with dignity for people who became unemployed. As such, it is an insurance program with social characteristics. To maintain the features of an insurance program, the unemployed person could not be subjected to any test of economic need. The payment of unemployment insurance benefits was calculated to produce the secondary effect of maintaining purchasing power. When many people in the community are unemployed and without income, their unemployment becomes a hazard to the well-being of the local society and the people in it. It was in 1933 that the Wagner-Peiser Act was passed by Congress, establishing a national employment system and forming a state-federal partnership in the promotion of such a system. Under the Social Security Act, which was subsequently passed in 1935, the states were required to adopt unemployment insurance programs acceptable to the federal government in order to be part of the partnership and for employers to receive a tax offset of 2.7% from the basic tax of 3% on taxable payroll. The 2.7% tax collected by the states was to make up the trust fund from which unemployment benefits are paid. And the 0.3% collected by the federal government goes into a trust fund which is provided to the states under Title III, grants to the states for the administration of the unemployment compensation and the employment service as well. Authority was delegated to the United States Secretary of Labor to determine the amounts necessary to administer the various employment security programs in the states, and Congress then would have to provide to the funds to administer them from those trust funds. With the passage of ORS 657-755, subsection 1 through 4 in 1935, the state of Oregon, as did all other states, by adopting similar legislation, agreed to accept the provisions of the Federal Social Security Act and thereby covered its citizens and communities with insurance protection against unemployment. The trust fund from which that protection is provided is made up of taxes collected by the Employment Division from employers in amounts now ranging from 2.6% to 4%, depending on the employer's experience rating. And this is on the first $8,000 of each employee's annual wage. Oregon's trust fund was at about $52.5 million on January 1st, 1977. $18.5 million of that is owed to the federal government. But we estimate that the trust fund will have in it close to $80 million by August 31st of this year, compared to $38 million last year at the same time. Our tax collections during calendar year 1975 were just under $62 million, and for calendar year 1976, just over $124 million. The unemployment insurance program provides payments to workers who are unemployed without fault of their own. In order to accomplish this, three questions were required. Number one, is the claimant a worker? A simple declaration by the individual that he was a worker is not sufficient to establish worker status. Such status applies only to those who have recorded recent and substantial employment. All states use some type of base period and require certain minimum earnings and or weeks of employment within the base period to determine those who meet the definition of eligible worker. In Oregon, it's 18 weeks of unemployment in the base year and at least have made $700, and there's a bill coming through from the House which will raise that to $1,000. Number two, is a claimant unemployed? Most unemployed insurance laws provide that a worker is unemployed if he earns no wages or earns less than his weekly unemployment insurance benefit. Number three, is the claimant unemployed without fault? Fault on the part of an unemployed worker is found when he does not, A, remain in employment when he would reasonably be expected to do so, in other words, a reason for separation from work, or B, conduct himself in a way that would logically result in his beginning suitable work at an earliest possible time, comes under the able, available, and actively seeking part of our law, or C, begin employment when he reasonably would be expected to do so. In other words, has to do with the refusal or failure to accept suitable work under our law. The fault, no fault principle permits establishment or of eligibility when the unemployment is caused by and continues due to events over which the worker has no control. Has the unemployment insurance system proven effective? And I submit that it has. In 1950, in 1958, 1961, and most notably in recently in 74 and 75, the nation experienced recessions of varying severity. These recessions have demonstrated beyond any doubt the real stabilizing value of income insurance for the jobless and for the nation. In calendar year 1975, $17,700,000,000 were paid out in UI benefits throughout the nation. In fiscal year 1975, Oregon's unemployment insurance system and federal supplements bolstered the state's economy with nearly $202 million, with an average check amount of $65.16 per week. In fiscal year 1976, nearly $195 million were paid out under all programs, with an average check amount of $67.10 a week. There are a number of bills affecting the unemployment insurance law, ORS Chapter 657, which have been introduced in this session. Nine of them have been submitted at the request of the Employment Division and or its advisory council. Four bills would bring the state law into conformity with the new federal law that was passed last year, which is Public Law 94-566. And was signed by the President on October 12th of 1976. These changes must be implemented by January 1st, 1978, and thus require consideration in this session. Briefly, these bills affect coverage of educational institutions, certain agricultural and domestic employees, prohibit payment of benefits to illegal aliens and professional athletes, establish extended benefit triggers, and affect other changes which I won't detail at the present time. Other bills for your consideration include a variety of proposed changes to the unemployment insurance law, some of which would be called housekeeping, but we're careful about using that word. And there are bills, of course, that were instituted by the House and by other members of the legislature. Other division staff members with whom you will be working along with myself include Ed Northcutt, who is my deputy administrator, and Ron Marin, who is not here today because he had to attend a meeting in Portland with the regional office people. He's the chief of the unemployment insurance program, and working for him is Libby Leonard, and she is here today, and she's our supervisor of benefits who will be carrying some of these bills. And Lee Russell, who is our assistant supervisor of tax, who will be carrying those bills that have to do with the tax measures and what we have to do with the employer bills. And he acts somewhat as an actuary for our agency as well, and many of you are acquainted with him because he's been around the legislature for a long time. In addition to that, Ed Nordyke is assistant attorney general who serves our agency and been with us 20-some years and is very familiar with our program, and he'll be helping us out and answer any questions that you have. We think and we hope that we can answer any question that comes up. If you ask for amendments to any of these bills, we will help you prepare them. We think we have the capability of doing that. Now, any request that you have, we'll try our best to carry out. We have distributed to you a packet which covers our entire program and gives you some idea of what we pass out to applicants claimants when they come into our offices, to give you some idea about what they receive and what we send out to employers, to give you some idea about that. We would like for you to be as well informed about our program as you possibly can be, and we'll do our best to answer any questions that you have. Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, if there's questions now.
Are there questions? Senator
Charles? Ross, you mentioned changes in the federal law that relate to educational institutions and so forth. I was wondering, one of the problems, I guess you'll call it a problem, that occurs in a community that has a major university is that you have a lot of people who are employed for a 9-month or 10-month period, and then the university closes down or half closes down during the summer, and those people are not employed, academic employees and others, for a couple months or 3 months. Are those people entitled to unemployment for that period?
Federal law is very close on this one. The academic people are not covered, and the classified people are. And this is a very unusual kind of a situation, but that's what occurs. Whereas the classified people in our high schools, grade schools, and community colleges are not covered the same as the academic people. But there is a bill coming through here that we have to make some changes to meet this new law they passed last year, and we'll be talking about it, so you'll be able to get right with it and find out. Within the perimeters of what we can do, what we're proposing and what the House has proposed. So we'll be talking more about it, because one of the bills does apply to what you're talking about.
It seems inconsistent that if in the school district the classified people are not considered covered and in a university community they are considered covered.
Well, it was a move by the 75 session when they included local school districts to follow the same philosophy that the federal government had when they excluded teachers at all levels, was the idea was that some of these same people are really not looking for work in the summertime, that the reason they work for the school district, at least that was the reasoning that was used, whether you agree with it or not, and that therefore they hadn't ought to be covered through the summer months. But there's some changes have to be made, and there's a bill here that covers that, and we'll be able to really get with it and answer any question that you have. And we'll be able to tell you where we have latitude to change and where we don't.
Any further questions now? Senator Roberts?
What state is your program in terms of finding employment for people? Because one of the problems when we're trying to deal with the significance of the unemployment figures is how we evaluate the effectiveness of the employment division in finding work for people and screening out those who are presently unemployed by choice.
Well, Senator Roberts, in the past, particularly in 1975, when the big rush was on, we were paying as high as 90,000 people a week. The policing of the program was not what it should be, and it wasn't in other states as well. However, we were one of the leaders in making payments promptly and seeing to it that people got paid, and that was a big amount of push that was coming from the federal government at that time. Since that time, we have initiated programs which are being copied and used in other states where we're sitting down with people particularly that have been on any length of time, and particularly those that have been on more than 26 weeks, and with a team effort between employment service placement person and adjudicator from the unemployment insurance side, and they're working directly with people to find out what it is they can do to help them get work if they've been out for some time. And this has been very helpful. We're instituting the program in all of our offices now. We're also being financed for it now, which we were not before. And it has been very effective, and it's just the kind of thing that you're talking about, and we're glad that we're at it and doing it.
Chairman?
Chairman Roberts?
What indicators do you have that you've used to measure the effectiveness of that program?
Well, we have all sorts of indicators, and we'll be glad to, because we're monitored constantly by the federal government on all these programs. We have copies of reports that we can give you of what the effectiveness of this program has been.
Are they prepared internally, or are they exterior?
They're prepared by our agency. However, there are reports that have to go to the federal government, and they are monitoring us constantly as to whether or not what we're doing is correct. And they come in and monitor as well as the government auditors are in.
Do they monitor you from Region 10?
From Region 10, yes.
How
sometimes
often?
The people come from Washington as well with them.
How often do they come through?
Well, this is an ongoing program. They'll pick two or three offices at a time.
In the state,
and then they come in, and then there may be a lapse of 2 or 3 months, and they'll come in and pick 2 or 3 offices again. But Libby Leonard is here with me today, and she runs that program as far as benefits are concerned, and she'll be able to tell you, I'm sure, whatever questions you have. And
how many offices do you have in the state now?
We have 42 offices in the state, something around 1,700 employees.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask another question if you want to move on? I can wait if you want.
I would rather that you wait. Maybe you'd be the right witness later on, Senator Roberts. It's all right with you. I would like to let Administrator Morgan orchestrate this program this afternoon because there are no sign-up sheets out there.
Yeah.
My understanding, you want a 2133 first.
Well, yes. The reason we do is because there's been a change in the signals from the federal level. We told the House Committee that there was no hurry about this bill. It has to do with the triggering of the extended benefits, because we didn't see that at the national level that the unemployment rate would drop low enough to trigger the program out until 1979 or 80. It turns out that two things have happened. First of all, the economy has improved more than we expected it to. Not only that, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has changed some of the rules of the game about how they figure unemployment rates. And so now there's a chance that as early as June or this fall, the federal trigger may trigger off. And Oregon, without this change in the law, would trigger off because of the trigger apparatus. And I'm going to have Lee Russell now explain the 2133 to you, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Any objections from the members of the committee? Is this all right? Thank you. Okay, proceed, Russell.
Lee Russell, Assistant Supervisor of Tax for the Employment Division. House Bill 2133 amends those factors necessary to trigger in or out of paying benefits under the federal state extended benefit program. Now, the federal state extended benefit program is a mandated program by federal law, but the federal law also puts some constraints on when and how a state shall trigger in and out of the extended benefit program. Public Law 94566, as referred to by Ross, did make some changes in these triggers, and House Bill 2133 is intended to adopt the trigger points as allowed by federal law, and so we would be in conformity with the federal law. A little background, basically, the extended benefit program has been in effect since 1972, or I should say 1971. We got in a little bit early in Oregon, earlier than most states. But there's two factors that trigger in extended benefits. One is a national trigger, and that's when the national unemployment rate is 4.5% or higher for three consecutive calendar months.
Pull up that microphone, would you? Closer to you. Pull up the mic.
The national trigger, when the national insured unemployment rate, 4.5% for three consecutive calendar months. The state trigger is in whenever the state insured unemployment for a 13-week period of time is 4% or higher, and 120% or 20% higher than the previous 13-week periods of the previous 2 years. Now, since 1974, this 20% factor has been waived in Oregon by the special session in 1974, permitted waiver of the 20% factor whenever federal law didn't require it, and federal law has not required this since that date. However, Public Law 94566 will only allow the waiver of the 20% higher factor only when the state unemployment rate is 5% or more. So 2133 contains a provision that the state trigger will be on when we're at 4% and 20% higher than the previous 2 years. However, if we're above 5%, we do not have to have the 20% higher factor. This was the level adopted by the House. The state was free to adopt any level they chose above 5%. They couldn't waive the 20% factor if we drop below 5%. The other technical change in the bill is the change in the national trigger. They're changing that 4.5% from a 3-month period to a 13-week period, the same as the state trigger, so both triggers are on the same period. That national change will not really have any real impact on the national rates determined. But the information we have received just recently is that the rate will drop below the 4.5%, probably in June or July. We think in Oregon, right at the present time, we're at a 7% rate for the most recent 13-week period of time. But because of the high unemployment in 75, we're only about 85 to 90% of the level in the preceding 2 years. So we have to have this legislation to waive the 120% factor when we're above the 5% level, reflected by the as adopted by the House, or else when we drop below the national trigger point, we would trigger out of extended benefits.
Might mention, Mr. Chairman, that we're nowhere near 120% now, so if the federal trigger went off now, say in June, and we didn't have this law in effect, Oregon would trigger out. And if you triggered out, you've got to be out for 13 weeks, no matter what your rate is. And it would also affect the federal supplemental benefits, which we're paying until next December, so it would have a great impact on the program. Might also mention to you that the legislature, Oregon, has the option of leaving it just like it is and letting it trigger out, or a minimum of 5% that the government put in, or you could have had 6% or 7% to make it trigger in. And the House chose the 5% figure, and that's what's in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, help me understand this. You probably already mentioned this, but I wonder if you'd do it again for me. For one thing, what do you mean by triggering out? And another thing is, what are the extended benefits?
All right.
Essential question.
Because of the thought that where states have unusually high unemployment rates, the federal government and the Congress decided that there ought to be more than 26 weeks, which we ordinarily pay is 26 weeks. Most states, there are some deviation from that, but most of the states in the country pay a standard 26 weeks of unemployment.
Mm-hmm. And extending it.
And they extended it 13 weeks.
Okay.
And they said if your rate at that time was over 4%, and that's high in some places in the East and the South. In Oregon, 4% is no high figure at all, but in some parts of the country, that's a high figure. If it's above 4% and it's 120% of the past 2 years at the same time corresponding, in other words, you've had a tremendous upsurge in unemployment. Mm-hmm. You could trigger on this other 13 weeks. Well, then what happened was, all over the state of Washington,
trigger on means just add on?
Add on the 13 weeks. And they pay half and we pay half of the benefits on that 13 weeks. That still remains the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, the state of Washington has done as well as Oregon. It did have over 4%, and they triggered on, and it's been burning it down. And then they never got over it. In other words, as it continued, they couldn't continue to stay above 120% because it got worse, but not that much worse. And so here they were with a situation not much better than it was before, and they couldn't reach that 120%. And there were 200 or 300 other states in the same fix. So then the federal government said, okay, if your legislature will move on it, you can leave that 120% and pay those 13 weeks. Washington met and did, and Oregon in its special session 74 did the same thing. Okay, now with this new law, they're saying, okay, to go back to base, if you go above the 4%, 120%, you can trigger on those 13 weeks, we'll pay half and you'll pay half. Except this, you can leave the 120%. If go to your legislature, you can set it no lower than 5% to waive it, but you can not waive it at all if you want to. No lower than 5, or you can go to some higher rate, whatever you choose. The House has chosen, and that's what's in this bill, of using the lowest rate of triggering on, which is 5%. And that's what passed the House. Thank you. Have I made it?
You
made
it.
All right.
Other questions? Anything else you want to say on this bill? Anyone else to testify, Ross?
No.
Is any action that
moved the bill? Is it ready to go in good shape?
Yes, it is.
Move the bill so far if it do pass. Senator Charles moves House Bill 2133, the due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Drumstead?
Aye.
Senator Roberts?
No.
Senator Trill?
Aye.
Senator Wires?
Aye.
Motion failed. You said no, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. We'll go to the next.
Go back to the. I think you need to stay here, Leon. Go back to the agenda now, could be, Mr. Chairman.
Which one?
2128, the first one on your agenda. Lee Russell would be carrying this one as well.
Is one of the bills that was requested by the Employment Division, and it will make several changes in the financing and other provisions relating to employers and their subjectivity under the Employment Division law. The major change is the rate that will be assigned to new employers. Since 1936, when the unemployment insurance law was first enacted in Oregon, new employers have generally paid at the standard rate of 2.7%. Until recent years, 2.7 was also the maximum rate paid by most employers. However, the recent recession in 75, 74, and early 76 required a substantial increase in the rates assigned to experienced rated employers, or those who had been in business for a sufficient period of time. So at the present time, the rated employers are paying at a rate, minimum rate of 2.6 and a maximum of 4%. A new employer can come in at the 2.7, which is almost the most favorable rate possible, and the only way that employer can go after he has been in business a sufficient period of time is up. The House Bill 2128 will establish the new employer rate at a level just a little bit higher than the average paid by all employers. It'd be somewhat below the minimum, the maximum, but fairly well above the minimum. The immediate effect would be to increase the new employer rate in 1978 to 3.5% from the 2.7. And that would probably be effective through 1980, possibly 81. After 81, when rates for rated employers are expected to decrease, the rates for new employers would also go down accordingly. The bill further provides that employers who are delinquent or fail to report and pay their taxes when due shall receive the new employer tax rate regardless of what their experience rate is, as long as their experience rate is less than the new employer rate. If it's more than, they'll receive their assigned rate. The bill modifies the determination of trust fund adequacy to include the impact of extended benefits. When the extended benefit program was first enacted in 1972, there was a special extended benefit tax to pay for those extended benefits. The regular tax adopted in 1975 session was set high enough to pay for the extended benefit tax. I mean, the extended benefit costs. Therefore, the determination of fund adequacy should include the impact of extended benefits. We are proposing a change in the determination of fund adequacy, which measures the level of the trust fund at any point in time on what next year's estimated benefit payout would be during a recession period. The current law measured it in terms of last year's payout, and we should have enough in the trust fund to pay a future recession, not a past recession. So there's a technical adjustment which will take care of that situation. We have included the Employment Division Special Administrative Fund in determining the adequacy of the trust fund. The monies in the Special Administrative Fund cannot be used to pay benefits without specific legislative authority, and therefore, if it's not available for benefits, it shouldn't be determined included in the adequacy. The bill reorganizes the provisions relating to notices of the employer tax rate and the appeal from that tax rate. At the present time, the employer receives his tax rate notice approximately November the 15th. He has 15 days to appeal or request a review of that rate notice. The proposal will extend that to 20 days to request a review. During that period, the administrator will, or we will review the tax rate notice, determine whether it was computed correctly and so forth, and give the employer a decision, a written decision, informing him that the tax rate was either correct or incorrect, and then the employer will have a 20-day period in which to appeal that written decision. After an appeal is heard on the tax rate and the employer is still dissatisfied with the decision, then he will be able to appeal to the Court of Appeals. All tax cases go from the appeals referee to the Court of Appeals, and this will place the tax rate appeal on the same basis as the other tax cases that we've had in the past.
Jim, can I ask a question?
Senator Roberts.
Why did you go to this method of essentially penalizing the employer on delinquency, where the result to each individual employer is going to be different depending on which schedule, whether they're on Schedule 1 or Schedule 7? In other words, the penalties are going to be unequal for the same action, which is a delinquent action. And instead of saying, to do this as a fine or as a penalty, what you said is that, as I understand it from what you said, if a delinquent, if they fail to file their tax reports and so forth, that they will go to this new rate, and that new rate is a variable rate?
No, the new rate will be the same forever. All employers in a specific calendar year. It may vary from year to year, but in any given year, it will be the same.
Okay. So it would have the same impact on everybody.
No, it would have. If an employer would have had an assigned rate of 2.6, and he was delinquent, he would go to 3.5. Another employer might have an assigned rate of 3.3.
And
he would go to 3.5 also.
So the person that had the lower rate would be penalized more heavily than the other individual, than the other employer.
And the employer that has a high rate is not penalized any because he gets his assigned rate. It's a little incentive for the employer to...
It's more incentive for some than others, isn't it?
I'm not sure how much incentive this is, because if an employer is delinquent in reporting or delinquent in paying taxes, there is another penalty that's assessed.
In addition to
that? If he's late in making his payment, we can assess a 10% penalty for the late payment of the taxes. Of course, one of the reasons we need, in determining the experience rate, if we don't have all the information for the period in which we're making an experience rating determination, if we don't have all that information in our files, we will have an inaccurate record of that particular employer's experience.
Every new employer coming online comes in at 3.5?
At the present time, it's 2.7.
Yeah, but with the
it would be 3.5 in 78. It might be lower in future years, depending on...
All right. How long does it take for an employer under present law to get an experience rating?
Depending on when he starts business, what month or what quarter of a year he starts business, it can be as short as 21 months or as long as 33 months. In other words, his account has to be chargeable with benefits for four calendar quarters ending on June 30th to get a rate for the following calendar year. For example, for 1977 tax rates, an employer starting business in March of 1975 would have been entitled to an experience rate for calendar year 1977. That meant he would have been in business 21.
There's one period of time when by experience rating, certain industries had a pretty low rate, down below 1%, if I remember
correctly. It was that way just before the 75 cession. There were rates as low as 0.8%,
right.
But because the fund went bankrupt, the rates just had to go up for everybody.
Yeah, but what is the lowest rate now? 2.6?
2.6 under the law, the schedule that's in effect at the present time. Now, if the fund gets built up to where it's an adequate level and more than an adequate level, rates could drop down to 1.2% minimum. That's the minimum that's possible.
Are there other questions on this measure? Any other testimony from anybody else?
There's just a couple of additional points in the bill. One of the sections will clarify that the leader of a musical group is to report and pay the tax on wages of the musicians in the group when there's a written contract specifying that the leader is the responsible party. It's not exactly the amendment that went into the House, but it's the amendment that came out of the House, and it does, I think, clarify that to a little.
What constitutes a musical group?
It's a trio, and one of the individuals indicates he's the leader of the group, and they have a written contract. And
in other words, don't get larger than a duet.
A musical group could be two people. A group is two or more individuals, I think. I don't know what, I'd have to ask the attorney what the definition of a group might be. Two or more.
Two or more, all right. Is there any exemption for these traveling groups that come through the state for one-night stands, or are they equally?
If they're a recognized group and they're just coming through the state, depend on what the state law in which they're incorporated or formed, whether that state would have jurisdiction on. We have an interstate agreement whereby individuals that are in interstate movement, like musicians, certain types of construction, and so forth, that the employer doesn't have to segregate his payroll by state. He can report it all to one state, and it somewhat would depend on the state in which he's organized. For instance, if Lawrence Welk came up, I'm sure Lawrence Welk is a registered employer in the state of California. Any members of that group that's employed in Oregon would be reportable to California. Now, if Lawrence Welk hired some individuals in Oregon for the Oregon job, then we would pick those people up as Oregon employees.
Any other questions? Do you have any further on this?
That's pretty well. There is one section that does authorize the division to reconsider erroneous decisions that in the tax matters that result from administrative or clerical error. Even though that decision might have become final. Once in a while, we find in an employer tax rate notice that we've erroneously charged the employer with some benefits. And we don't find out about it until after his tax rate has become final, but we feel that if it shouldn't have been in there in the first place, we should go back and correct that rate notice and give the employer the correct rate that's applicable to him.
Is this erroneous decision determined by your...
Generally based on information that the employer provides to us after the decision has become final, and he may not recognize it until 6 months until he gets ready to pay his tax. That's primarily where the situations come in on tax rates.
Chairman, sometimes an employer will ask us at the end of the year, you know, for a complete listing of all the people that gave against his account. And when he examines that, sometimes he finds that some of those should have been non-charged. And for some reason or another, we made a mistake. And unless we have some latitude to give them relief, and that's what this law is trying to do, we were unable to do that once the decision became final.
Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Then Robert.
On a musical group, this brings up another question. How do you determine if you've got a certain of people that are working together on repeated jobs, like somewhat like the situation we're in when we're discussing the question of contracting and subcontracting and whether or not people are covered by working comp or not and who is responsible? How do you determine that if you've got a group or a collection of people that are in that kind of a relationship with one another? How do you determine whether they're partners or...
We have to look at the particular facts in each situation, determine is it a legitimate partnership. I mean, and if they've met all the requirements, they're a three-way partnership and the filed partnership papers, file partnership income and so forth and et cetera, we would undoubtedly hold that they were all three self-employed individuals and not covered. If each of them received a certain amount for each engagement, depending on what the terms of the contract, whether the purchaser of the music had direction and control. We have to look at that aspect of it. Who has direction and control over these musicians? Does the purchaser have the right to hire and fire the individuals, tell the individuals what type of music they're going to play, so forth? We just have to look at all the factors in each case and settle each one on the facts that's applicable to that particular case. The only exception is this section of the law says that if there is a even though they may be employees under all other common law rules, if the contract that the individual leader has signed says that I, as the leader, I'm the responsible party and will pay all taxes, then he is, in effect, the employer of the other members of the group.
Oh, so you're defining the leader as the person who signs the contract with, say, a nightclub owner or something like this, as opposed to someone who may be a leader of a musical group officially in terms of the public's mind, but they might have someone else who is the person who arranges for the contract and signs for them.
The leader would normally be one of the members of the group, not an agent. I mean, if it's an agent...
It could be the person who can't play a musical instrument, or who can't sing, but simply is the person who runs the thing. Now, by leader of musical group, you mean the...
Whoever signed the contract and said, I'm the leader of the group, whether he plays or not.
That's how you're going to define leader for purposes of
this. This particular section has been in the law since 1965. And
no wonder you're having trouble with it.
The main reason we've had problems with it is we get a three-person group, for instance, and the law says the leader shall be the responsible party, but when it comes to facing them with, they said, well, responsible for what? We're all self-employed individuals, so therefore there's no tax due. And we hope this will clarify that they are employees. There's some employees in that group, because normally if they aren't a recognized separate group. Do you want to make a comment?
Yes, Senator Roberts, this language was worked out between the lobby representative for purchasers of music, the clubs, the various clubs, organizations, and the musicians' union. And they were the parties to the original law as it was passed. So they're satisfied with it at the present time, and we can administer it. We don't have any difficulty.
It's always been a problem, because in particular, now since we even have taverns who employ maybe one or two musicians, and they don't even find out that they're not reported on the payroll. They don't even find out that they've had them until that person comes in and makes a claim. And that's when the problem starts, as to whether or not they're employees or whether or not. And it will continue to be a problem, but we have no way of writing anything better than what they've agreed to try to administer the program any better. It's just going to be a continuing problem to us, but it isn't something that's unbearable that we can't work out. And it's the best language, and it's the union and the association decided this, they could live with this, and so that's what it's passed in the House. And so they're living with it, and it will continue to be a problem because of employers not really considering a musician, particularly if they just hire one person to sing. You've seen that. Whether or not they really are paying the payroll tax on that particular person, because they'll pay them in cash at the end of the day. I know they do this because my boy sings in these places, and they just give them so many dollars and it's over. And so I know it goes on. So long as it's students, we don't have a problem, because they usually don't come in and apply for unemployment insurance. But when someone older gets involved in this, we get into a picture where no payroll tax has been paid, and it becomes a problem. And even when it's a group, like three or four people get together and, form a little group, and they go out and play. everything's fine. So you find out that they had a contract, but they really didn't have a contract, and then they get a new employer, they'll change who's the leader. In other words, they'll have a leader. One guy will be the leader at this place, another guy will be the leader over here, another one over here, and if you think that wouldn't cause problems, we start trying to collect taxes. But there's problems, but we don't know of a better way than what's in this law. So.
Other questions? If not, let's go on to the next.
2129. Libby Leonard, who is our supervisor of benefits, will carry this with the table with the chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Libby Leonard, supervisor of benefits with the Employment Division. House Bill 2129 has a number of different types of things in it. They are not all strictly connected the way they were in the last bill that you heard. One thing it does is assure that when the federal government issues a regulation that covers certain workers in some of the federal manpower programs, such as CETA, Work Incentive, some of the other economic opportunity programs, that we at the same time will have that coverage. They actually assume the responsibility for these benefits. But with our original language, before we made this change, we were finding that as their changes came along, we weren't keeping up with them. So the language in this bill just ensures that they will be covered. Another thing this bill does is define what is a retirement program sponsored or participated in by an employer for the purposes of administration. It does not change the law in that we will still deduct retirement pay as we have been doing under current law, but it makes a definition of retirement which will make it much easier to administer the law. There's a change in recovery of non-fraud overpayments. At the present time, we are allowed by law to use the offset of future benefits only during the benefit year in which the overpayment occurred and in the 52 weeks following. What happens is that when that law was written, we didn't have the extended benefit program or the federal supplemental benefit program. So now instead of a regular 52-week benefit year, we are finding that some overpayments occur perhaps 2 years after that benefit, that claim was filed. And we have no way of using the offset of future benefits under current law to recover those. This change in the law merely gives us the leeway to say when the decision's written, then we have a period to offset. Another thing the bill does is to say that we can write off overpayments which amount to not more than 1 weekly benefit amount. At the present time, that's $102. After 3 years, when we have been unable to collect them during those 3 years, we lose sight of a number of claimants we attempt to collect. We attempt through Department of Revenue to collect on income tax refunds, state income tax refunds. But some of these people just disappear and we never see them again, even though we cross-check with employer records. They're not working in Oregon. This way, instead of just having these overpayments, these small ones sitting there forever, we will be able to write them off if they're of that small amount. And we do have a number of those.
By number, how many do you mean?
Well, at the present, if this bill were to pass, I can't give you the how many of them there are, but we would write off about $147,000 to begin with. And that goes back 20 years. We've had no way to get rid of them. They're just sitting there. And they're just a ledger. This was, in fact, suggested by both the federal and state auditors. They said that it's just a ledger entry that we have to keep track of all the time, and they suggested we have a method to get rid of the small ones. We've never been able to write off one that's even $1. We have nothing under the law that allows us to do that. The last part of the bill is in regard to charging employers, and the changes there First of all, it allows us to charge local government entities with the full amount of any extended benefits. This is required by new federal law. Another thing it does is delete the provision that's in the law now where an employer is not charged if he continues, if he has a part-time worker working for him, and that person loses his full-time job and starts to draw partial unemployment benefits. We have in the present law a method to non-charge that employer. It's used very seldom, and it's a very complicated process, and it has raised an issue of conformity with the federal government. So we are deleting that section in this bill. Another thing it would do would be, at the present time, if an employer has someone quit him for a reason not attributable to him, he can, in a subsequent benefit year, request relief of charges. Now, this is the next benefit year after the one in which the quit occurred. He can, at the present time, do that if somebody was fired or discharged for misconduct. This bill allows the same thing to happen. A request for relief of charges may be considered if he fired the person for misconduct. And lastly, the bill extends the time limit for requesting charge relief and requesting hearings from 10 days to 20 days.
You go back, just one statement on that. If an employer thought that he was unjustly charged, or the fellow quit on his own volition and then went in and requested unemployment insurance, and then the employer found out about it, he now can do it in the next calendar year, or will this law allow him to do it in the next calendar year?
No, as far as quits are concerned, there's no change from the way we're doing it right now. If a person voluntarily leaves work without good cause, and the employer is the last employer and a base year employer, we automatically relieve that employer's account of any charges for the benefit year in which the quit occurred and the subsequent benefit year. If a person files a claim and he had quit his base year employer, the base year is what is the first four of the last five calendar quarters that sets your claim. If he quit his base year employer quite some time ago, but today he comes in and he was merely laid off from his last job, his base year employer could be charged with his benefits unless that employer requests to be relieved and says, this person quit me 7, 8, 10 months ago for a reason not attributable to me. Now we can relieve the employer. The question came up of, well, then why can't we do the same thing if somebody was fired for misconduct and we showed it on a prior claim? Why can't we do that? So this allows us to do that.
Any questions?
Rachel. How much, what has been the range in the amount of errors? In other words, what are we talking about? You come back, say, a year later, and what kind of money might be asked for? Are you coming after people for like $1,000 total overpayments? Is it run that high?
Well, the overpayments, now one of the most common overpayments, I don't call an error, although it gets lumped into erroneous overpayments. You may have heard of the Java decision, which was a Supreme Court decision about 5, 6 years ago. I can't give you the exact year, which required that once we make a determination to pay at any level of the process, the appeals process, in any state agency, we have to continue paying until some further decision becomes final, which might say, no, you shouldn't have paid. What happens is we will, for instance, let's say that a local office adjudicator makes a decision that this person quit a job with good cause. The employer appeals it. He goes before a referee at a hearing, and the referee says, well, first of all, we would start paying. We would be paying that person benefits because we'd made that decision. The referee says, no, it wasn't good cause. Now we've already paid him perhaps 8 weeks of benefits, and that sets up an 8-week overpayment. Well, at $102 a week, you've got over $800 overpayment right now. And this can happen anyway. We could make the decision, no, it was a quit without good cause, so we don't pay for the 8-week disqualification. Goes to a hearing, and the referee says, yes, it was good cause. All right, we immediately go back and pay him for those weeks that we had not paid him. The employer takes it to the appeals board, and the appeals board reverses the referee, and we're right back to having an overpayment again because we have to pay whenever we get a decision that's final that says to pay.
Any questions?
You can see where I'm probably coming from, though. In other words, I'm concerned about the person who, through no fault of theirs, might be all of a sudden liable. And after they've been in unemployment and everything, they're usually in sorry financial shape anyway, even maybe years after, if all of a sudden they're liable to be socked with a lot of money that they really have spent that just isn't there.
Well, we do not require on any kind of an erroneous over, unless there was misrepresentation or fraud on the part of the claimant, we do not require repayment. We would only withhold from future benefits.
Oh, okay.
So the only way they get hit is that they wouldn't get some benefits that are coming to them this week and next week and next week. But we would not require, we have make no collection effort on those.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Go on to next.
Next bill then is 2130, and maybe that's when you're going to carry that one too, I believe.
First part of the bill is a part which clarifies the some of the definition of employment, and really it's just rearranging the language. It makes no substantive change. It then goes into coordinating Oregon's definition with the surrounding states. We've been finding that we've had a problem where one state will say the base of operations in this state, and if we don't use the same language they're using, then we end up with nobody wants to say that that claimant worked for an employer based in that state. This language gets us in line with the states that we work with, and it is a suggested federal language so that most states will be doing it the same way. It's merely a way of getting somebody covered in some state, someplace, and somebody responsible for his unemployment benefits. There are a number of places in this bill where we have just changed a few words that were bothering us because of perhaps court decisions or appeals board decisions. They make no substantive change, although I'd be glad to go over any of them with you if you desire. We did take out one section that specified a presumption of inability to work if a person quit due to illness, injury, or pregnancy. And now we still would look at a person's ability to work anytime they file a claim for any week, but we don't have the automatic presumption that they are now unable to work because they quit 6 months ago for a reason such as that. There's a section relating to fraud. We have always had, or we have had for a number of years, a penalty for fraudulent claims that could range from 1 to 26 weeks, depending upon the severity of the offense. However, the way it's worded, it just says you start the penalty now and it just continues for 26 weeks. Well, during that time, the claimant who had committed the fraud could be working and couldn't care less whether he had a 26-week penalty running out at the same time. The wording we are suggesting in this bill says that he will be penalized for weeks when he's otherwise would otherwise be entitled to unemployment insurance. So it actually makes a penalty out of it. And the last part of the bill is a complete rewrite of one section of ORS 657, section 265. It does not make any drastic change. It gets it into a more, into a kind of a chronological order as to what happens when a person files a claim and how the employer gets notified, how the employer can tell us about the facts and the separation and the employer and the claimant's rights to appeal any determination that we make. It also extends the appeal time limit from 10 to 20 days.
Any questions? Well, I'm sorry that more committee members did not hear this. And you
I think there's one more bill if you have
time. Oh, is there?
I'm
sorry.
I'd like to have Assistant Attorney General Ed Nordyke on this bill, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ed Nordyke, Assistant Attorney General and counsel to the Employment Division. This bill grew out of a problem that we have been experiencing with respect to settlement agreements between public employers and their employees. I think perhaps the best way to explain it is, let's say, for example, that a public employee is dismissed from his job, and he appeals to IRG. and either Herb orders the man reinstated or they reach a settlement agreement. Now, during the period that he was unemployed, he drew unemployment benefits. The public employer under the law is required to reimburse the trust fund 100% for those benefits. So, in reaching the settlement agreement, they frequently provide that they'll pay him all his back pay except for the unemployment benefits that he received. Now, that's fine, except that the public employer frequently doesn't pay that money over to us. They say, well, we've collected, we're happy, but that doesn't end the problem because frequently the employee had wage credits in both private employment as well as public employment, and the settlement agreement should have been, the money should have been turned over to the employment division so we can credit both the private employer, the taxpaying employer, as well as the public employer, and secondly, so that we can reverse the overpayment decision that was entered against the employee because he drew benefits at the same time he was being paid. So that's what this bill is designed to do, is to resolve that problem that we've been experiencing in these settlement agreements. And that's it.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's all right. Closes the hearing.
You did a very good job, but your coat didn't show up.